Hey everyone, it is Nick Bradley here. Welcome to this week's show. So joining me on the show today is Dan Kremins. Now, I was going to introduce Dan by saying that he is a recovering private equity guy like me, but that wouldn't be 100% true because whereas I work with business owners who are wanting to build a high value exit to private equity, to sophisticated buyers, Dan works with the private equity firms themselves, but he works specifically with their portfolio companies, helping to increase their value. So what we're going to get into today is the way that private equity firms specifically increase value, you know, expand value with their companies, and the nuances, the differences, if you like, between the way a business owner can prepare for an exit to private equity versus what they're going to experience when they kind of go into that world. It's a really rich conversation, a fireside chat, so to speak, around all things scaling and exiting. Now, a little bit more about Dan. So Dan has spent something like, 13 years in private equity. He says he stumbled into PE in 2007 and kind of got stuck there. But what I really like about his career is not only has he worked on the financial side, the deal side of private equity, he's also worked on the operating side. He's had several CEO and kind of senior leadership roles within portfolio companies. The other thing I really like is his experience is very much focused on people and how that you can create value creation, understanding the human capital side of things. And where I think this is a big change, certainly from my experience and my career in private equity, is that the PE firms now have to think a lot more of the strategic and operational value that they add to the companies they acquire. It's not just about how well they can deploy money.
We became very proactive and intentional about identifying what does this business need in a CEO to get from 10 to 100, just, you know, following the example through. Do we have that in the incumbent leader? If no, which the answer was no in a lot of cases, we got to get on with it in very early days in the whole period, make a priority getting the right CEO in there.
So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. We're going to go through a little bit of Dan's book, which is called Winning Moves, which is an excellent book around how private equity create value. And we're going to touch on the specific things that you should be considering, you should be thinking about, particularly if you are preparing your business for a high value exit to a sophisticated buyer in the future.
Begin with the end in mind of what does success look like at the end of the road? And for the private equity firm, the end of the road is 5 years. For the management team, the end of the road should be 10 years because not only do they have to get us to 5 years, but they need to sell the dream to the next buyer.
So there we have it. That is today's show. Two private equity guys going backwards and forwards. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the show, Dan Kremins. Hey everybody, it is Nick Bradley here. Welcome to Scale Up for this week. And I am delighted to say that we are going to have a bit of a masterclass in private equity today because I have a gentleman joining me on the show who has a pretty full-on illustrious career in private equity, has spent a lot of years in the trenches, has managed to dig himself out of the trenches, but still plays with one foot in, is probably to describe it. Welcome to the show, Dan Kremins.
Thanks, man. Thanks so much for having me. I can't promise a masterclass, but I can tell you plenty of things not to do in the private equity.
Well, that's a masterclass in our book. We were joking before pressing record. It's going to be a bit of a fireside chat. We do have some topics that we think are very important to get into today, but we're just going to go backwards and forwards and talk about some of the stories, I think, because it is a crazy world. And whenever I speak on stage, Dan, and I talk a lot about private equity just because it's, you know, where the game is played for a lot of people who want to create certainly an 8 or a 9 figure exit. There's this kind of mystery, intrigue. Like as soon as you mention it, it's like, oh my God, what's that like? Did you find that? I mean, have you found that when you bring it up? Because, you know, because obviously your background's not dissimilar.
I have found that, especially dealing with business owners who don't have familiarity with private equity. However, being a, you know, born and bred Midwestern state school kid from the US, I sort of stumbled into private equity in a way that didn't, you know, see me ascending through high finance as a lot of the private equity peers do. I sort of dumb-lucked my way into a role with a private equity group back in 2007. And so I think my path has been perhaps made it feel a bit more approachable to me. But to your point, I deal with that a lot when dealing with founders who haven't dealt with private equity before. And a big part of it, I wrote a book, which we may or may not talk about as we get into it, but I wrote a book a couple of years ago that is in part aimed at demystifying private equity for the selling business owner, such that they can understand better how does private equity think about businesses, and in so doing, sort of remove this veil or this mystique that surrounds the business.
It's an important message, and we were saying that where you and I probably differ a bit is you still work with the private equity firms with their portfolio companies,
right.
Whereas not that I'm not allowed in the room anymore, but when you jump to the other side of the table, and as I said, I work with the business owners. You know, there are two sides here, right? And when you're getting into high stakes, you know, 8, 9, sometimes more sort of figure exits, there's a lot of risk there. So let's go through your story. So 2007, you got into private equity. What were you doing before that?
So I did my undergrad here in Cincinnati, where I now live. We just moved back here 2 years ago and spent the early chapter of my career working in operations management for a short period of time. So I was running a logistics and supply chain organization for a small privately held company here in Cincinnati, which gave me great early experience in the fundamentals of managing people. And then I did a bit of a hard left career-wise and did a fairly short couple of year tour of duty in investment research, working for a investment advisory business in the Midwest. And what's interesting is private equity, the firm that I landed at in 2007, in a way that wasn't well planned out, but sort of melded those two worlds in a sense that fundamentally the private equity group was, they were investors. And so I could draw on some of my early investment, you know, experience and judgment in doing that part of the job description. But we also happened to be very involved, active investors. And so I knew, while I was not a seasoned operator at that point in time, I knew a little bit about how things run on the shop floor. Which I think just made me, again, I was still relatively early in my career.
What was the attraction then? I mean, obviously, so you went from operations to some interest in investment, as you said beforehand, which obviously then takes you into a pathway into private equity.
Yeah.
Did you know much about it at that point, or did you start to learn about private equity when you were starting to get more into understanding investment research?
I didn't know an EBITDA from a debt service coverage ratio.
Okay, you know, right. Early. Okay, got it. Early stage experience.
I had experience in, I was a finance major in undergrad, accounting minor, entrepreneurship minor. So I knew finance. But you know, the application of finance to private equity is relatively unique. And so I had to make some of that translation. That was a big part of the learning curve for me early in private equity, was just understanding how do the fundamentals of finance that I have learned and begun to exercise in my career, how do those actually apply to this very unique world of lower mid-market investing? And that was a bit of a learning curve. But a lot of, as you know, just a lot of new, not only a lot of new applications of the same fundamentals, but a lot of new language that I had to understand early on. And that's why I say I didn't know an EBITDA from a debt service coverage ratio, only half jokingly.
Well, you know, let's be frank about this to some extent, though, right? Some of those words, and I've learned this since leaving, because when you're in there, you're kind of programmed, right? You're kind of indoctrinated into a way of doing things.
Yeah.
I've learned that some of those words that are thrown around are there to confuse people. Right. So not to say that they're not important. You need to know what EBITDA stands for and what it means. But there are other things that are thrown around that are just complex, because they sound intelligent or they want to confuse. So
I think it also is, I don't mean to interrupt your flow, but I think it also is, and I say this from personal experience, first 10 years of my career, I was a prolific user of private equity jargon. And that was in part because I learned a fancy, you know, shiny new skill and I wanted to show it off. But that was also in part because I was a relatively young guy, early career, who was in a lot of rooms that by traditional standards, I didn't belong in. You know, I had a massive case of, as many of us do in the space, had a massive case of imposter syndrome. And so one of the antidotes to that imposter syndrome, at least in my subconscious brain, which is using a bunch of big words that made me feel a sense of self-worth and belonging in a space where people had all sorts of fancy degrees that I didn't have.
I get it. It's the same as if you go to McKinsey or BCG. I did a stint in BCG for a while, and it's the same thing, because people come through, they might have great academic qualifications, which gets them in the door. But then when you're in there, you're kind of around these other people, but it becomes its own language, its own narrative. And I think, you know, back to the early part of our conversation about the mystery of private equity, some of it is that baffling with BS, the kind of, you hear these words, so therefore it must be smart and intelligent, and it creates a hierarchy.
Yes, totally. Well, and I learned pretty early in my So I had some early operating experience when I got into private equity. I landed in the space in 2007. Global recession hit in 2008. I don't know if you heard about it.
Oh, well, yeah.
Yeah.
I was at Getty Images buying companies. We had a great time.
I can imagine. But, you know, the point being, I during the 08, 09, even 2010 period at the firm I was with, we had battened down the hatches. We were all hands on deck trying to get our portfolio companies through the recession. And so I stepped into one of our companies along with one other guy from our firm to lead the transition, the management transition of that business. What I learned in getting early operating experience in a private equity backed business is the sort of use of jargon, some of the bad habits that quote unquote high finance teaches us can be massive liabilities in a business. For example, you know, I still remember this vividly. One of my earliest experiences within my early operating experience was landing on the ground in Louisiana at a small office. We were trying to open a market in Louisiana with this company that I was helping to lead. And I showed up with briefcase in hand, you know, blazer on, dressed as the private equity guy. And I walked into a warehouse in the middle of Louisiana with a bunch of guys sitting around, you know, with wearing jeans and tattered t-shirts. And I walked in like the record scratched and everybody looked over to me. And I learned that you really have to meet your audience where it is, not only in look and style, but also in just the language you use, the way you are approaching them. And that's not to say I was better than or worse than, or it was just a very different environment. And I learned an early and kind of painful lesson in the fact that some of these things that private equity teaches us can be real liabilities as an operator of people in these companies, a leader of people in these companies.
Yeah. No, indeed. And it has changed a bit. I remember I was in the PE world when chinos started to become more popular. And it was kind of weird because you had half the firm would turn up still in the navy suit and the white shirt. Sometimes, yeah. Well, they weren't wearing ties at that point. It was very cool just to have the cool suit and the shirt with the buttons done, yeah. Undone. And then people started wearing chinos and kind of sports coats. And that was kind of weird. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah. I have a question for you here, because I think this is an interesting one for you to kind of take is, how do you define the world of private equity? So I've talked a lot about this on my show and kind of what it's like, secret handshakes, secret clubs, all sorts of stuff. And that was my experience, certainly in the UK, where most of my PE kind of working has been. But how do you define the world? So when you're in it, what does it feel like? What are some of the key kind of things that happen? Just so you can kind of unpack it for people listening.
Well, I think the world of private equity is changing. And so I'll give you maybe two answers, a point in time answer from 2007 when I joined and the point in time answer from today.
Perfect.
And I think just to level set, broadly speaking, I would define in the most simplistic term, private equity is are providers of private capital to invest in things. A subset of the private equity market, that broad definition of the private equity market, is the world in which I play, which is mid-market, lower mid-market private equity, mm-hmm. acquirers of small, medium-sized companies that are typically privately owned or founder-owned.
Yep.
So that's like the broad classification in the world that when I speak about private equity, I really speak through the lens of that second subcategory.
So, by the way. And I talk about it in terms of big P, little, big P, big E, little P, little E in terms of that. So there's private equity, which is exactly your first definition. Yep. And then there's the firms and how they operate.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I like that. I like that a lot. 2007, when I joined the space, private equity to me felt synonymous with deal makers. The business was largely focused on, we have a pool of capital from our limited partners, from our investors. We need to deploy that capital into small, mid-sized companies. So private equity was largely a capital allocation game. Uh-huh. Fast forward to present, and there's a lot that's happened in between that we can unpack, but fast forward to present day, private equity is what I just described. You know, the price of admission into the private equity game is you have to raise money and do deals. But there's an and function that's been added over time to private equity, which is investors now have something productive to say and contribute when it comes to how do we actually create alpha or value post-closing once we own these companies. So private equity, the definition of private equity, the feel of it has expanded considerably to focus not exclusively on investing, but investing and operations/value creation. How do we buy good businesses and how do we make them better businesses under our ownership?
Yeah, okay, I agree with that fully. And there's a differentiation there. I'm going to add something to it as well, because I think it's important. I mean, a lot of people who listen to this show are investors and business owners of different sizes, right, of course. And what you'll find that's interesting is when I was floating around, my last proper private equity gig was 2018, 2019. Interesting story about how I left that company in a blaze of glory, but we'll come back to that. Yeah. And then I can't remember the exact figure. I was talking to Adam Coffey about this, but there was like 3,000 to 4,000 firms in North America or something. And now it's like double that. And the point I want to make here is you've got kind of three tranches of private equity that I see in the world today, right? You've got the traditional firms that still do traditional things, right? You know, they have capital, they deploy it. They're quite aggressive in the way that they operate. They're very traditional. They're what I call the old school private equity. You're 100% right that they are starting to get disrupted by more progressive private equity firms that are bringing people in who can actually add value and partner with people. And the idea that when you sell the business, you're not just selling the entity, you're actually partnering up with someone who can take it to the next level. That's really interesting. But then you've got this kind of at the bottom end, all these websites that have gone up in the last 2 or 3 years since COVID that are private equity firms, right? And just for everyone's reference here, they're not, right? They're people who have done a course somewhere. They've put up a website saying they're an investor, right? And they're going to go out there and do no money down deals or whatever you want to call it, seller finance deals. And I just bring that up, not that we want to talk too much about it here, but just to say that if you're in there looking out there at the world of private equity, there are different layers, different levels. Some are what I would call real, so what your definition is. Others I would call just be careful. Be careful of the letter or the phone call from someone who doesn't really have the capital to acquire your company.
Yeah, well, I think you're right to point out the different private equity is not private equity is not private equity. And you have, you know, this builds a case. What you're describing builds a case for having a trusted advisor at your wing if you're a business owner that's considering selling. And trusted advisors can come in all shapes and forms, but somebody who knows the landscape you're describing, who can serve as somewhat of a river guide in helping you to find the buyers that are actually a fit with your goals and objectives. It's so important for business owners that aren't private equity experienced and maybe can't discern between some of these, you know, these different.
You've got to navigate the minefield, right? And you know, I liked your point though, because the last few private equity firms that I was associated with were more of the latter camp. Sorry, the kind of more premium end. In other words, they have the capital, but they also have the operating expertise to help. And what I'm finding these days, certainly the deals that I'm involved in, where differentiating between those firms, certainly anyone who wants to sell to private equity, we're talking to those firms, and it becomes a much more difficult conversation because, you know, there might be a price that's put down for the business, but then it's about, can I get on with these people? Because I'm going to be around for at least, you know, 1 or 2 years on some form of earnout. I might stick around and roll over some equity and play again. But then there's the piece about, you know, is this the partner that's going to help take the vision of the company forward? I think it's a really, the reason I'm sort of making the point again is that's in private equity, that's kind of what exists now as an opportunity. So people who think private equity is bad because of the traditional, you know, stigma, actually it's not. And these newer type of firms are operating, I think they're excellent.
What to your mind and what in your experience discerns a quote unquote good partner from a less good partner?
Yeah. And this is where, I mean, I always talk about price and terms as the things you need to look into, with terms being more important than anything else. Terms being defined as, it depends on what your personal end game is. It depends on what the vision of the business is. And it depends then on what the core capability is of the firm that you potentially will sell and partner to. So all of those things have different answers. But let's say, for example, and I talk a lot about the exit story or the growth story. Right. When we work. So the idea is that, you know, you're going to hand the baton to someone else who's going to take that baton and run the next leg of the race. Okay. Some firms are fantastic at international expansion. Some firms have a great track record within your industry and have, you know, bolt-on acquisitions lined up and ready to go. Some firms focus more on cultural dynamics. Some firms have more of a bias towards technology enablement. And what I often get people to do is when you're interviewing, and you are interviewing the firms through a process, you start to ask them the same things they're asking you, right? And then you start to build up a sense of that. And then you've got the human element, which is the rapport between the people, which is obviously critical. So that's kind of how I play it these days. And I'm finding that private equity firms are now starting to call it maybe marketing, but they're creating their own brand propositions, their own value propositions, so that they can differentiate themselves in the ways that we've just been discussing.
This is so, I mean, the point you're hitting on is so key, which is the in today's day and age, look, 6 to 12,000 private equity firms, depending on how you define private equity, 6 to 12,000 firms out there, yep. Trillions of dollars of capital. This is, let's just call it what it is. Private equity is a red ocean market. If you're familiar with red ocean.
I am. I study that at INSEAD, my friend. And I love it. I still bring that up every day with people, but let's unpack it quickly though, Dan. So just define red and blue ocean quickly, because I know some people will know it, but we should always do a, hold on, here's a footnote.
A blue ocean market is, think of a blue ocean market as uncontested market space. The book will just define it more precisely, but think of a less competitive, uncontested market where you have a real opportunity to become the market leader. Red ocean is the opposite of that, where it's ruthlessly competitive. A lot of Me Too sort of companies. Yep.
Blood in the water, as they say. All the fish competing for scarce amount of plankton.
Right. Yeah, great metaphor. So in a red ocean market, if you want to survive, let alone thrive, it's incumbent upon firms to find their points of differentiation, step one, and step two, be able to articulate that in a way that's clear and compelling. I remember doing, this was back in probably 2011 or 2012, as one of my little, you know, the firm I was with at the time was, we were probably 8 to 10 people. And so everybody was doing a little bit of everything. I was doing deals. I was, you know, sitting on the board. I was cleaning the dishes like the rest of us were. And one of the projects I took on was to help revamp our website. It was atrocious back then. And so the first thing I did, I was taught, in business school to, if you're trying to figure out what's your messaging and positioning, step one is to go out to the market and understand, well, how are your competitors messaging and positioning? How can you find your sort of way to wedge in?
Yeah. And what language are they using as well, which is critical.
Bingo. So what we did was we went and scoured, I grabbed one of our interns or analysts. We went and scoured like 100 private equity websites to understand how are people positioning. And we actually began to tag and codify some of the language they were using. And this idea of vaguely describing the firm as a good partner, value, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes for those not on video, value add partner. It was all the same BS. And that's not to say they weren't value add, but it's to say that in a market that's becoming increasingly red ocean, you have to build points of differentiation that are substantiated by actual operating activities that are different, and B, figure out ways to articulate those in a different way. So I think all this said, you know, fast forward, whatever it's been 10 years since that time, the market's become more competitive. The onus is increasingly on firms to find ways that they are demonstrably different such that they can stand out in a deal process where you're often competing with, 20 to 30 other buyers.
Well, side note here, if you've got a branding agency and you want to go and think about another market to play in, yes. I think being a branding agency for private equity firms could be an interesting place. Side note.
If you reach out to me, this is an idea I thought of spinning up. I convinced myself I didn't want to be running an agency, but I'd love to find a partner who's interested in cracking this nut.
There you go. Well, I'd come in on that one as well, actually, because I think that'd be fun. Well, yeah. Last question on private equity before we kind of get into some more meaty topics. Same question back to you that you went to me, right? In terms of when you look at private equity firms now, and I know you work with them, right? So you're in there helping their portfolio companies. When you see the good ones, or what you define as the good ones, what are the characteristics? The ones that you think are the most progressive and the ones that are really starting to adapt to the red ocean, to the fact that they need to be more competitive?
I'm going to speak in generalities and then I'll give an example. The good ones have identified a series of activities that they can meld together to be both different and valuable.
Okay.
That's very broad, but let me use an example. I'll use the example of the firm that I know best, which is the one I worked for 13 years. The firm is called Alpine Investors, based in San Francisco. Okay. We realized probably 11, 12 years ago, that we're really not in the capital allocation game per se, we're in the talent allocation game. And there were a variety of lived experiences we had as a firm that taught us that bringing people to the center of the private equity equation was going to be increasingly important to our success. We looked at the deals we've done, where we've had success, where we failed, and one of the highest correlated factors with success for us, or lack thereof, was the quality of the leadership team and the intentionality with which we brought great fit-for-purpose people into the business. So that light bulb taught us that we've gotten pretty good. The firm had been around for 10 to 12 years at that point. We've gotten pretty good at the capital allocation, the deal-making part of the business. What if we dedicate the next 10 years to getting really good at the people allocation business? And that became the seed that formed the people-first strategy that Alpine ended up pursuing. And that was an example of we identified an activity or a strategic thrust that we thought was going to be very valuable to our business. And we figured out how to articulate to that to the market such that we could attract people being talent and business owners with whom that
point of differentiation,
that value proposition resonated.
What did that, just because I'm curious, how did that change how you were structured? So what type of capability did you have to bring into the firm to be able to do that value add piece successfully?
It came in, there was a bit of a crawl, walk, run when it came to the evolution of it. And it's still evolving. Alpine has just done amazing things and the firm's crushed it. It's really been a validation of the strategy. So it's been an evolution. But I think when we had this realization that people were important, the starting point was, how do we attract and identify good fit-for-purpose talent for our portfolio companies? So what did we do? We stood up a sort of recruiting function. This is where a lot of firms start. A lot of firms that are leaning into human capital stand up a recruiting or talent acquisition function, and then solidify our point of view on how do we figure out what is fit-for-purpose talent for a given role or company? And then how do we create an assessment process and a structured interview process that allows us to suss that out such that we can make high-quality hiring decisions? So that was the starting point. Over time, that evolved considerably to where once we figured that piece of it out, and we were always getting better and making mistakes and learning from them, but once we largely figured that piece out, the next horizon was, okay, we're getting pretty good at going out to market and finding good talent for our portfolio companies. What if we create great talent from within? And instead of having to go out to market and rely on recruiting all the same great CEOs that everybody else is trying to recruit, what if we create great CEOs from within? So that seed formed the basis for what is now the CEO in Training program, which 10 years after its inception has, we've had, 50 to 100 people pass through that program. It's one of the most, the returns that it has generated from CEO in Training backed companies have been insane. Insane is not a legal term. But
you can say what you like here. It's all good.
So the point being, crawl, walk, run, let's get in the game. Let's start to stand up some capabilities that can allow us to actualize this people first strategy. And then let's just constantly have our head up to understand what's the next horizon that's going to add sort of turbo boosting fuel to this strategy.
The reason I'm smiling a lot here is in our core program that we work with business owners on, the first thing we talk about is people performance maximization. Like, we have a thing called the people performance maximizer, which is partly because every business that I went in did turnarounds, which is, I'm sure that's how you help us a lot now, is we just have to get rid of the people and bring different people in, without being, too romantic about it. It was like, right people, right seats drives value. Once you've got that wrong culturally or capability wise, it's one of the things that cripples businesses. And I remember I learned when I was working with a mid-market private equity firm in London a number of years ago, one of the guys there said, listen, it sounds ruthless to say this, but changing in and swapping out the CEO and until you're getting that right, even though it looks like it causes massive disruptions, it's still the quickest pathway to value creation. Because I was always of the thought before that, which is like, well, you're destabilizing the culture and the people and all that. But the numbers, if you look at it from the numbers, prove the point. But, obviously you have to do that the right way or the best way you can as well.
That jives with my own lived experience in private equity. We used to have a slide on our fundraising deck that showed the performance of companies where we backed the existing CEO compared to the performance of companies where we brought in a new CEO within some defined time period. And the actual performance statistics were night and day. Favoring situations in which we proactively brought in a new CEO. And I think it's important to say, that's not to say that founder CEOs that we had backed are bad leaders. Quite the opposite. It takes, and I learned this through working alongside different founders as a board member and as an operator. It takes a real skill set that I probably don't have to get a business from, you know, zero to 10 million or zero to 100 million in revenue. However, it's the old saying of what got you here ain't going to get you there. For a lot of companies, the skill set in a CEO that got you to 10 billion isn't going to be the same skill set that gets you to 100. And some can cross that chasm. Some can evolve as leaders. But statistically speaking, very few have in our experience. Yeah. And so we became very proactive and intentional about identifying what does this business need in a CEO to get from 10 to 100, you know, following an example through. Do we have that in the incumbent leader? If no, which the answer was no in a lot of cases, we got to get on with it in very early days in the whole period, make a priority getting the right CEO in there. Understanding that can create some transition pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can do that in your own business before you sell. And a lot of the stuff I talk about with business owners, particularly if they don't have succession planning in, is realize, you know, where you've played the game well, but where it's time to bring in someone else to kind of, you know, finish it off or take it to that next point. And I find a lot of the business owners that I work with, they can get a business to, let's say, 3 to 5 million net profit EBITDA, right? There's a way of getting to that, which you could argue is getting close to eight figures, right, in revenue. But then to take that business from that 3 to 5 up to 20 million of EBITDA, right? You know, possibly pushing the 100 million of revenue, whatever that looks like, that's a different skill set. You know, you're going to be doing very different things, different decisions in terms of what the business footprint needs to look like, the optics and all that sort of stuff as well. And quite often understanding that that's the bat and pass moment is an important thing. I think both before you sell your company, if that's where you're at, but also obviously through a transition process.
I do, just to affirm what you're describing, I do a big part of what I do nowadays in my advisory business is organizational due diligence. So pre-closing and working with a private equity firm to go in there and develop a point of view on the leadership, the talent, the culture, and the capabilities that exist within the business and how those map to, or don't in a lot of cases, map to the investment thesis that the deal is being underwritten to. And I will say that the presence of a clear successor, to the extent that the founder is trying to transition out or doesn't have, or has acknowledged they don't have the skill set to carry it forward, the presence of a successor is an exit multiple booster. The absence of a successor is an exit multiple drag.
Yep. Love that. Exactly what I'm going through this right now with a business, and we're in the process of hiring that role. It's going to be a president role because we haven't got it. Right. Like, you know, we have a couple of people who could do it. But as I said, you know what, like, you don't want to have the coulds, right? Because they're going to go to assess very quickly. Right. And, you know, private equity with, you know, internal rate of return and the speed to kind of realization of the invested capital. Like, there's no mucking around here. Right. I love what you're doing about getting people ready to be CEOs and putting them in. But I also know that if someone's got training wheels and an acquisition gets done, that can be a big risk as well. So let's talk now. I definitely want to spend a bit of time during this conversation talking about building a high value business, right? And maximizing the value of a business through the process. So, you know, I talk about this a lot, but I want to hear your view. And I know your book, Winning Moves, covers some things on this. But if you're a business owner listening to this now, they understand what private equity is. They understand that the opportunity for an 8 or 9 figure exit is most likely going to be there, actually. Could be something else, but that's a big part of the market. What do they need to be doing and thinking about, you know, let's say 12 to 36 months before they want to even start a sales process with a banker or whatever? What are some of the things they have to be thinking about now to maximize that exit value for them or the multiple as well?
In the most fundamental sense, I think business owners need to be thinking about how do I build a business that buyers, the sort of buyers that I want to attract, would be lining up at the door to buy. That doesn't tell you much about what is that and how do you go about actualizing it. But I think that's the starting point for this conversation is begin with the end in mind. If my goal is to build, is to have a multiple maximizing exit, which is some of the language I use in the book, start by thinking about what does a business need to look like to achieve that? And what I like to do, so, you know, in my private equity days, one of the plays we would run early in a hold period in the first, you know, 3 to 9 months is do an exit planning session with our leadership teams. And a lot of leadership teams that hadn't been through this process would think that that's weird. Hey, we just did this deal. Why are we talking about the exit? And it's for the same reason I just mentioned. Begin with the end in mind of what does success look like at the end of the road? And for the private equity firm, the end of the road is 5 years. For the management team, the end of the road should be 10 years because not only do they have to get us to 5 years, but they need to sell the dream to the next buyer. And so we would think long term and say, what does success look like in the business in order to have a multiple maximizing exit? The simple frame of mind I like to step into that conversation with is thinking like a private equity buyer. If the goal is to create a business that private equity buyers are going to want to buy, we have to understand how do they think and how do they assess businesses. And
well, let's go through that. Let's go through specifically that, because I think that's interesting, because you know, you've got different people out there like the Exit Planning Institute selling kind of what I call generic kind of stuff, right? It's pretty basic stuff. If you haven't seen it before, it looks new, but it's pretty basic. If we go into the private equity mindset for a second, right, ruthlessly into that, right? Yep. What are they looking for? What are the things that are, if they see it, you know, the multiple goes bing, 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 bing. That's up, by the way, for people, because they don't know what bing means and I'm talking into a microphone. Or it goes blah, 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 down. That's down, right? So what are those things? Because that would be interesting. We haven't covered that before here.
I'll give you like the off the top of my mind, the top five. And there's more in the book on this. But so for backdrop, every private equity buyer, for people who aren't familiar with the space or haven't been through a deal with private equity, every PE buyer has a criteria sheet that spell out what are we looking for in a business, in an investable business. And every deal that they do or are considering doing, they hold the deal up to their criteria list and say, how well does this map? And so the criteria are going to be different depending on the style, the strategy, the end market of the firm. But here are five things that I think are pretty universal. What are private equity firms looking for? Minimal enterprise risk. So what's the call to action for business owners? Over the whole period in private equity lingo, or over the lead up to a sale, an eventual sale process, systematically identify and eliminate or reduce enterprise risks in your business. And in so doing, your exit multiple will go up.
And the key risks are, just give us the summary, because I know there's lots. If you run a due diligence process, there's like 70 pages of this stuff. But in principle, there's obviously legal, compliance, things like that. What else?
Legal, compliance, regulatory. There are business and commercial risks such as customer concentration. So if you have customer concentration and you recognize that 4 years or 5 years out from an exit, in the case of the exit planning, you know, timeline I shared, make a priority to diversify your customer base and your revenue base. Key person risk is another example of a business or human capital related enterprise risk that can weigh on your valuation. So if you have key person risk, what do you do over that 4 to 5 year period? Backfill and cross train those key people. So the big message.
Got it. And a lot of that, just to add on that very quickly, because again, I just want this to be useful for everyone, is when a due diligence process is run, right? And I actually get businesses to do what I call a shadow due diligence process at the very beginning of working with me. So we actually do that within the first 12 months. So we get a really forensic view of what to work on these risks. But anything that due diligence kind of assesses is kind of what we're talking about here, right? Not entirely, but predominantly. And that's quite a robust process at the best of times.
Yeah, we think about it similarly. There's a winning move. I'm busting out my handy-dandy copy of the book I wrote, Winning Moves, right now. Winning move number 90-something is to do reverse due diligence on your business.
Oh, perfect. There we are. I knew you'd be aligned.
It's just another way of describing what you're describing, but it is to say, poke holes in your business, poke holes in your raft and see if it still floats. If you look at your business like a buyer would and understand what are the vulnerabilities or the weaknesses that could impair our exit value. And then provided you have done reverse due diligence early and continuously, feed those weaknesses or those deficiencies or those things that need to get shored up back into your operating plan and make them priorities in terms of things that you need to get shored up in the lead up to the exit.
Got it.
So I'll get you there.
Got it. So obviously minimizing risk is the first thing, right? And we just went through kind of what that could look like. Let's go for 3 to 5 of the big things that the private equity mindset would be looking at.
I'll list them and then we can click on which ones you want. So what does private equity like? Minimal enterprise risk. They like predictable revenue. The high growth end markets.
Yep.
Increasingly they like M&A opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So ability to scale via M&A.
Ability to scale via M&A, a proven ability or the prospect of scaling via M&A.
Yep.
They like, if number five that I think would make the list is the presence of a management team that is capable of actualizing the value creation agenda that said private equity firm is underwriting.
Yeah, I agree with that. But it's particularly, we're talking about portfolio acquisitions here, where they're buying the structure, the process, obviously the people, the operation to scale from, you know, and that becomes, it's called a platform for a reason. Right, in the platform that you then grow from. Let's jump into recurring revenue, because and you called it, I think, predictable revenue, right? So let's talk about the importance of that and why, because this is something that I think, particularly when I work with business owners on sort of their scaling phase, the majority don't have this, or they get confused by it and they think it's just a subscription or whatever else. How do you define it and why is it so important?
Well, it's important because more predictable revenue equals better visibility, better stability, and visibility and stability in combination can be inputs to higher growth. If you have better stability and visibility in your revenue base, it allows firms to make bigger bets, more aggressive investments in growth. And so those are the reasons why recurring revenue or predictable revenue is important. And you're right to point out there are a bunch of different flavors of recurring revenue. I list some of these in the book, but it's not just subscription revenue. It can be, in the case of service-based businesses, retainers. Mm-hmm. There's the old razor blade model. That's another flavor of recurring revenue. There's like 10 to 12 that I list. I did a workshop on this that I put on the Winning Moves portal, the digital platform that supports the book, where I list out 10 to 12 different flavors of recurring revenue. So it's not just subscription, but all of these flavors achieve the same thing, which is just better revenue visibility and stability, which allows these investors to invest more aggressively in growth. And there's all sorts of cases for businesses that don't have high, you know, recurring revenue or predictable revenue today. There are lots of case studies out there. I referenced some of these in the book of companies who have found ways to add more repeatability, predictability, recurringness to their revenue base. You see this even in the automotive space, where jury's still out on whether this model will take hold, but you see more automotive companies that have begun to dabble in subscription models, which is just a sort of a derivative to the old leasing model. We saw this in a plumbing and HVAC business that my old firm invested in a long time ago, which is not really recurring revenue in the classic sense, but if you add a subscription agreement or a service agreement, $99 every year, we'll come out and check your systems. That's a great way. It's a great tactic to use to add to the predictability and recurringness of your revenue. So message being, there are creative ways for even less predictable revenue businesses to make their revenue more predictable, and in so doing, boost their exit multiple.
Do you find that obviously just having it increases the value? So if you haven't got it, you got it, that increases the value. What about the percentage of revenue? So let's say, for example, I am one of those HVAC businesses, because example, I work with one quite recently where we did add a service kind of membership, if you want to call it that. And I think it was going to end up being like 15% of their revenue once it got going, right? So quite small. What happens in that situation versus a, let's say, more of a SaaS-based business? Let's say it's a profitable SaaS business, not just a tech business, where like 80% of their revenue is recurring. Is that automatically a higher valuation because the percentage is higher? Or is it like, obviously, it depends on different characteristics. How do you think about that?
I think it depends on other characteristics, but I'll paint in generalities to say the 80% recurring revenue business will definitively be, all else equal, will definitively be higher value, higher multiple than a 15%er. So the general rule of thumb here is the more recurring revenue you have, the better. The less recurring revenue you have, the lower the exit multiple you can expect. And I referenced this stat in the book, but as I was writing this part of the book on recurring revenue and its impact on the exit, one of the studies I found concluded that a dollar for buyers of businesses, they are likely to value a dollar of recurring revenue 3 to 5 times greater than a dollar of non-recurring revenue. Now that's very general, but if you want to do the simple math on your business, just multiple, take the, you know, comparing the 15%er to the 80%er, just apply that 3 to 5 times markup on every dollar of recurring revenue.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense
for what is the delta that is created by having less recurring revenue.
It makes a lot of sense on the basis that I look at it through the lens of organic and strategic growth, right? So we used to kind of say organic growth is your dialed in kind of marketing sales strategy, right? So however you're going to market now, right, without anything too clever. And if you can pivot that, or you can evolve that to be more focused on a recurring revenue model, right, then it creates more stability for the buy and build strategy, the acquisitions.
Yeah.
Because you kind of don't have to go hunting for a customer each time. You've already got customers coming in. You're managing the customer journey. You've got repeat purchase, building lifetime value, all from a recurring base. And then when you go and bolt other acquisitions on, you can flip them into that model, or you can actually add them on top of something which is more predictable, repeatable, sustainable. So that's how we would look at it. And I try and get that across all the time to say, because lots of people come to me and say, I just want to buy other businesses. And the first thing we do is go, well, hold on, let's have a look at your current, you know, revenue model, and let's understand how that works, because you might be able to optimize that first, or optimize that as well as going out and doing the clever stuff. So yeah, I like
love it.
So let's talk a couple more things before we wrap up. So I did ask the question also about, like we said, about what does a private equity firm look for? What are two or three red flags that, like, if they came in, the business might, we talk about businesses look attractive from the outside, but they might not be built ready for a transition. What are two or three red flags that if you see them straight away, it's kind of deal off?
The easy one is the opposite of some of the pluses that we've talked about. So let's move beyond that. I think another red flag, this is more process related as opposed to something that is germane to, the business or its revenue composition, is learning about things deep in the exit process or the buying process from the perspective of a buyer that you should have known about, you wish you would have known about early on. So like I've done a bunch of exits like you have just within PE-backed companies. And early on, when I was leading or involved in exits, it's easy to have this fear-based mindset of, hey, there are things about this business that a buyer's not going to like. We need to sort of put lipstick on the pig or window dress them such that the buyer can't really understand them. And that wasn't disingenuous as much as it was just the way that, you prepare anything for sales, try to make it look as good as possible. What I learned having traveled through a few sale processes and learned the hard way, the consequences of that approach is every buyer understands that there are things about a business that are going to be less savory or appetizing. Now, your goal as a seller of a business is to make that list of things as short as possible, back to the earlier conversation. But there are things about the business that are going to be, perceived as weaknesses or gaps. What I learned over time is don't let a buyer discover those things at the 11th hour in a due diligence process. That is a great way to blow up.
Critically important. Yeah. And if you find something, you're better off being honest about it, because if they find it later on, you're just wasting time and money.
Be honest about it and articulate a plan to how you're going to shore it up. That is a great credibility booster for a seller, is to say, here's a balanced 360-degree view of our business. Here's what has served us today and how those things are going to have positive impact going forward. Here are the gap areas that we have identified. By the way, whether you've identified them or not, a smart buyer is probably going to identify them. So it behooves you to reverse due diligence your business, understand the weaknesses, be prepared to articulate those, and be prepared to describe the plan that you and the management team are going to pursue to shore those things up.
Love that.
So I think that's another one.
The key point you said there, though, is it builds trust, right? It builds that relationship, which is critical. Because as I said, and to be clear again, when you sell your business, unless it's like a strategic exit where they're going to, move you out pretty quickly, you're partnering with this firm, right? And a lot of that, to be able to get to the next level or just enjoy the next couple of years, yeah, it's all about that relationship for sure.
It adds trust to the relationship. It also inspires confidence in the buyer to say, every private equity buyer understands there are going to be things about businesses that are weaknesses or gaps. A CEO coming out and saying, I'm clear on what those are and I have a plan for addressing them, is a sign of CEO maturity.
Yep.
And the sort of CEO that I can have confidence in, as opposed to the counter opposite, which is the CEO that is either blind to the risks in their business, the weaknesses in their business, and or is playing hide the ball on those risks.
Well, we were talking before about, as I said, a lot of business owners in my world, they come in as that, curious amateur, we want them to be the worthy opponent. The worthy opponent meaning that I can play the game on the level that's expected. Yeah. And half of that is about confidence, right? It's about showing that you're confident, and therefore there will be confidence in you to be able to take the business to its next piece. Even if you don't hang around, remember the sale process is not about necessarily you sticking around for the next 3 to 5 years. It's convincing the person who's buying your business that everything you've made decisions to date are going to be transferable to them. And certainly for the immediate period of time, everything's going to kind of work. So super important.
Right.
Cool. Any other ones any glaring other ones we've missed, Dan? I want to make sure we have a complete conversation. There's a lot we could talk about. This could be like 10 hours, but yeah, red flags. I mean, obviously massive legal. I mean, okay, let me ask you this question, because I think it is a big red flag that I've seen. Legal, any litigation, any case, right? That the, you know, it could be all sorts of different things, buying out partners. It could be, you know, a customer has an issue with an order that's escalated. How much clear water do you need before that case is dealt with and put to bed before you would go to market? Or is it okay to kind of sell the business with some litigation going on? Or again, does it depend on what that level of risk is on that?
I think it just depends on what is the nature of the litigation, or the, you know, and what is the magnitude of the risk. I have sold businesses before. I've been on the sell side of deals where we had ongoing regulatory or legal issues. That we follow the same playbook of let's address those on our front foot. Let's try the best we can to get those things sealed up before we take the business to market. But that's not always possible. And so let's address those on our front foot and let's articulate our plan for getting these wrapped up, if not pre-closing, post-closing. So I think it is a bit situational, depending on the magnitude of the risk that some sort of litigation presents. But I think it's possible to sell a business even in light
of that. Particularly if everything else is great, right? Like, you know, there's a piece here where I talk about the 15 different things that a private equity firm would look at, and that's a simplified version of it, but it's kind of the big things, and we've touched on a few of them. And I often say that, like, you know, you can sell a business if you've got 80% of these green, right? Meaning they're kind of optimized, and there's a few that, in fact, it kind of looks more credible sometimes when you show up and say, this is where we're awesome, right? And we can prove it, and we can show you the track record through metrics, optics, all those things. Here are the areas that we're working on, and here are some opportunities of what we would do with a different partner and different investment. And that kind of balanced view of the business is actually, again, back to the point we said about a more credible positioning. Yeah. It makes you look honest and real. That's a really, I like to frame an exit process or the start of an exit process with that type of narrative. I think it works.
I love that. I love the 80% rule of thumb. That's a great simple way to think about it. And furthermore, having some things about your business that are under optimized, if not weaknesses.
Mm. Yep.
Also can help accomplish something that I think is important psychologically in the sale process, which is to make the buyer, make them feel like they have the potential to be a hero of this next chapter's journey. Yeah. To the extent that these are issues they've seen before, not only would that make them a worthy partner, they can help you to button up some of these things that you don't know how to button up or haven't yet gotten to, but it also psychologically makes them feel a sense of worth in the sale process. Yep. Hey,
well, it gives them a quick win as well.
Something to this deal.
It gives them a quick win. And you know, there's a thing here where if you're going through the process and you say, listen, we've tried to tackle this, but we haven't, we have some ideas, and you know, the potential buyer goes, yeah, well, listen, we've done that. We know how to do it. You know, remember, at the end of the day, the new buyer wants to kind of get that return on their investment as quickly as they can. So if they get a quick win in the first 12 months of an acquisition because it's been clearly identified, it's been clearly assessed and can be worked on and fixed, that's going to, again, make the business more attractive. So these are good points, I think, Dan, because sometimes people kind of look at it at a surface level and they go, oh, I've got to tick the boxes, right? You know, whatever it is. And this is where I think some of the, we talked about the Exit Planning Institute and others, it's great in terms of it gets people awareness, but it doesn't go to the level sometimes. And that's why you have to, I often say the first part of selling your company successfully is be getting educated on the game, right? Just learn it, right? Read the books, read your book. I've got my book coming out soon. Learn the game, and that's going to make it so much better for you when you go through the process, for sure.
Bingo. And I'm sure this is the same for you as you write your book, but that was a big guiding principle for me in writing this book, is I got clear on who my audience was, which was a combination of private equity investors and portfolio company operators. And for the latter group, one of the big objectives of the book was to back to the first part of our conversation, demystify private equity so that operators, whether private equity operators or founders that are considering selling to private equity, understand the mental model that private equity uses to evaluate businesses and create value in businesses post-closing. That allows you to then speak their language, overcome this language gap and language barrier that often exists in these exit processes. It allows you to better position your story, your exit story, to the mental model that is already pinned to the brains of these private equity folks. So I think that the point you made is so key.
Good fun. Well, that's
what is your book going to be about? Are you allowed to say?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, it's writing a book is an army, isn't it? Or they say it takes a village to write a book. Oh my God, yeah. It's 2 years in the making. It's called Exit for Millions, and it's the byline, if you like, is the private equity blueprint for scaling and selling your business for maximum value. So what I go through is my experience of how a private equity firm, buys a company, but then goes through the value expansion exercise with the premise that if you learn this in advance, a lot of it we've talked about, so there'll be definitely some symmetry between your book and mine, is if you know that in advance and you can prepare in advance, A, you're going to have a better outcome, but you're going to enjoy the process a lot more. So yeah, it's a comprehensive guide, my friend.
I can't wait.
I'll make sure you get a copy when it comes out. If we've got a couple of minutes, you've got a couple of minutes to finish. I think we should finish with this last piece, if you're okay. Yeah. You posed this question last night before, obviously, we got onto this today, and I thought it was a really interesting one. And it was, how investing, right, makes you a better operator and how operating makes you a better investor. So I think, why don't you answer that and answer, just articulate what you mean by that, and then I'll answer from my side. And I think that's a nice way to wrap up our conversation today.
Well, what I meant by that was I had a realization somewhere in the middle to most recent innings of my private equity journey that despite the fact that I sort of stumbled into both private equity investing and operating within a private equity environment, I've realized the incredible power, the 1+1=3 power of having experience across both of those domains, investing in small, mid-sized companies and operating within small, mid-sized companies. And so, things that you get as an operator that I got as an operator that helped me as an investor. Number one, operator empathy, an understanding of how things really look and feel, what the day in the life is on the shop floor. You, of course, understand that and experience that sometimes in challenging ways as an operator. But then, going back to an investor context, and just for background, I have done a lot of in and out of a private equity, from a private equity firm to an operating role. I've probably gone in and out.
That's great experience. That I think that is rare as well. Like I came in purely as an operator, right? So I had to have an appreciation, I think, of what I call the spreadsheet jockeys, is what I used to call them as a joke. But the fact that you've done both, right? That's not a common thing. I mean, maybe it's becoming more common, but I certainly in my days it wasn't.
Yeah, totally. Totally. It just gives me the first thing that operating gave me as an investor was operator empathy. You show up at the board meeting. After I had operating roles, I would show up at board meetings for companies that I was on the board of. And the CEO would say, hey, we have, in a very stoic way, we have experienced a challenging loss of a key team member or management member. Here's the current state of play. Here's what we're doing about it. Sort of the classic sort of board level report out. Prior to having operating experience, I would have looked at that at its face and said, okay, like what are we doing about it? What's next? How are we going to get shored up? Post having operating experience, having dealt with the pain that can sometimes come when you lose a key member of management, the first place my mind goes is, man, that must suck.
Yeah. Like, are you okay?
I understand you're pulling double duty, Mr. or Mrs. CEO right now. Like, you doing okay? Are you, like, is your stress under control? Do you feel like you can see the light at the end of the tunnel? Are you doing okay? And if yes, then proceed to, okay, what are we doing about it? What do you think is the right time frame for getting that role backfilled, et cetera? And that's what I mean by operator empathy.
Yeah.
That's one thing it gives you. I mean, the other thing that being an operator has given me as an investor is just an understanding of how to actually drive change in a mid-market business where the only way to achieve our returns is to orchestrate change. From the ivory tower, what I used to think is, and I'm oversimplifying for dramatic effect here a bit, but what I used to think is you create the model, you show, you know, we need this margin expansion to hit our returns, or we need this revenue growth. And you just add sprinkle pixie dust on it, and it magically comes true. What I realized on the shop floor in an operating business is, in order to achieve those sorts of changes that will drive revenue growth or margin expansion, you actually have to get people to do shit that they haven't done before. And that's not always easy. It can be very challenging, especially in businesses that are used to being founder-owned, maybe are less progressive, less growth-oriented. So it just gave me a real understanding for not only the importance of driving change, which I know is an overused cliche in the space, but the importance of driving change in a playbook for how do you actually tap into the hearts and minds of people, help them understand what's in it for me, and get them to lean into a new way of operating, or get new people on the bus who have the ability to
Well, what
sort of.
you're talking about in the most, I suppose, simplest way of articulating it is strategy versus execution, right? And to answer the question, and just for context, as I mentioned, I was very much the operator, right? So I was not coming in from the financial background per se. My background was sales and marketing, and I was a CEO multiple times. So I came from that lens. Where it really hit me, was at Getty Images. Now, Getty Images, I've talked about a lot on the show, you know, massive buy and build kind of strategy, like multiple acquisitions, you know, into the billions of valuation. But there was a guy from the private equity firm who acquired us, who was from the firm, put on the investment. And what normally happens is, obviously, there's a board, you have key members of the management team from the business that's been acquired, and you have a number of people from the private equity firm, and there's usually a chairman put on there, all these things, but there's usually a lead person from the private equity firm. And we had this guy who had, like, you know, the Harvard MBA, probably 28, maybe 30 years of age. And everyone else was kind of more seasoned. I was young at that point in time too, but, like, certainly the founders of Getty were, you know, in their sort of probably 40s or whatever. And it was a bit of a joke. This guy turns up, right? But oh my God, if there is a unicorn that exists in private equity, it was this dude. This guy came from a blue chip financial background, but he could win people over on execution like you've never seen. And by the end of it, he was like almost running the business, and he'd never run a business before, right? And the point I make here about investment versus operation, right, is there is, and I think you articulate it really well, Dan, there's this kind of interesting middle ground, right, where, you know, strategy is super important, right? But it can't be created in a silo, right? Strategy has to be translated into execution, and it has to be out, then obviously deployed with rigor, with precision, with focus. And for me, I think if you understand the financial lens and the strategy lens, but then you understand how it needs to be delivered, hearts, minds, execution, all the things we spoke about, that's where the magic exists. Right, absolutely. And that the people I find that work really well in private equity understand that point. That's probably the summation of, I think, what I learned in over a decade in that world.
Yeah, it's a great case study. And it's not an either or. When you get into these sort of heady discussions about what's more important, strategy or execution, there's all sorts of clever quotes out there that make the case for one or the other.
I know
It's
the
like,
ones.
well, both are important. Both are important. Business leaders within a private equity-backed business, or any sort of business that's aspiring to do big things and grow and create equity value, you need to have a clear sense for. I'd like to boil these things down to just some really simple, clearly articulated questions that business leaders need to be able to answer. You need to know where you're going. Call it your vision, call it your BHAG, call it your whatever. You need to know where you're going. You need to know, how are we going to get there? Call it your strategy, your value creation plan, whatever. What are the steps that we're going to take, the strategies that we're going to employ to get to that vision? What needs to happen next? Okay, so we know the vision, we know the strategy. What needs to happen next? What's the next, you know, 10 yards of the race? What needs to happen next quarter, next year to move in that direction? Number four, who do we need aboard? So business leaders, I don't know that one of those is more important or less important than the other, despite what some, you know, thought leaders may try to build a case for. But there's a cascade there and sort of a building exercise to where you need to be able to answer all four of those questions to build a durable, scalable, growth focused organization.
Agreed. And I think that's a great place to finish up. Very good. So, Dan, this has been great, mate. We could have gone on for hours. I knew that would be the case. Did we cover everything that you wanted to cover? Because I know I know you've got your book, which is fantastic. And again, I'm going to recommend that people go out there and buy that if they want to learn a little bit more about what we've talked about. It's called Winning Moves, which is great. And just give us a minute of kind of what you're doing now and where people can kind of reach you and kind of what your focus is, that sort of thing.
Yeah, what I'm doing now is I spun out of a full-time fund level role a couple of years ago to start an advisory business, basically taking a lot of the things I was doing as an investor and operator that had impact and productizing those and bringing those to other private equity groups and their portfolio companies, all aimed at driving this thing I call people-powered value creation.
Nice.
And so specifically, the things that we do are pre-closing organizational due diligence, which we referenced earlier in the conversation. Post-closing, I do a lot of work with leadership teams, their boards, their investors, getting everybody aligned on really these four questions we just put on the table. And then downstream of that, do a lot of work on how do you marry talent using talent strategies, people practices that you embed in these businesses. How do you marry talent back to that value creation plan such that you have the right people in the right roles focused on the right things to enable your value creation agenda to come true. So that's a lot of what I'm doing right now. I post a lot on LinkedIn, the things I'm learning out there in the space. And so link up with me there. And be on the lookout for probably another book in the next couple of years.
There you go. When you get the appetite back for it. Yeah, Dan posts some fantastic content on LinkedIn. That's how we kind of connected in our crazy world of private equity, actually. So I wanted to have him on the show because there's a lot of value that he's putting out there every single day. So definitely connect with Dan on LinkedIn. And I'm sure, sir, our paths will cross in this world. Maybe from me in the process of getting a business ready for private equity, and then it transitions nicely to you working with them with the portfolio companies that go into your private equity world. That'd be a nice baton pass for sure.
The one-two punch. Thanks so much for having me, man. I love what you're doing in the world. There's such a need. I've seen it from the private equity side. There's such a need for the work that you're doing. So keep at it.
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today, Dan. It's been really, really great content for everyone here. And I appreciate that very much.
Thanks.
Hey, thank you for listening to this episode of Scale Up with Nick Bradley. If you enjoy the show just as much as I enjoy creating it for you, then I'd really appreciate you leaving a 5-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And while you're there, why not subscribe to the channel so you never miss a future episode? It really helps me, it helps the show, plus it makes it easier for others to access the content that I'm producing week in and week out. And finally, if you want more information about anything you heard in today's show, or to find out how you can get more help in scaling up your business and your life, click the link in the show notes now to learn about our coaching, mentoring, and mastermind programs. See you soon.